You're listening to RPP 98.7, Your Story Counts, with Nanette and Simone. And in the studio we have Lee Russell.
Woo-hoo. Good morning.
We're heading for a top of 17 degrees.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Hey, Lee, welcome.
Thank you. It's a bit different being interviewed rather than being the interviewer. So this will be interesting.
Yeah, we're having fun over here. It's much easier being this side of the table.
Yeah,
so it is. Wait for your turn.
That's right. We can't wait for Nanette's turn.
Look at you two. I'm already getting nervous.
I know.
Anyway, it's all about Lee today.
Yeah, it is. It's all about Lee today. Yeah. And a big story and an important story.
Yeah. So do we want to start off with where were you born?
I was, I'm a Melbourne girl. I was born in suburbia in Epping, so very, very northern suburbs. Mm-hmm. And I guess Epping 40 years ago wasn't the Epping we know today. So mm-hmm. it was very different. It was not city. It was not
country.
It was sort of somewhere in between. Yeah. And actually I found growing up in Epping quite a difficult thing.
Yes.
I remember really thinking that I just didn't belong. I hated the suburb. Even the trains hated it then.
Yeah. You know, so funny.
There was only like one train an hour going into
and
the
everyone
city.
Held their breath as they went through.
Yeah, yeah. It was sort of a very different place than it is today. Mm. So I very much struggled with living in Epping and you know, never really feeling like that was kind of home to me.
No.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So what was it about Epping? Was it just a hard time in Epping? Like, did people struggle there? Like,
yeah, well, I'm a child of the 70s, I guess. So, you know, coming out of the 50s and 60s, a certain style of parenting, certain style of, you know, people were working hard, but they'll partying hard as well.
Yeah,
and so, you know, there was sort of lots of working class, lots of families doing it tough.
Yes.
You know, I remember my neighbours getting their school uniforms wrapped up for Christmas presents from Santa.
Wow, yeah.
You know, those little sorts of things. You laugh now, but at the time it's quite confusing to a child. And I guess coupled with that, I had quite a dysfunctional family. Mm. I had a father who was very abusive.
Yes.
Very much the centre of the family's universe.
Yeah, the household,
Right. So I was the eldest child. I've got two brothers after me. And I just, the overriding feeling really was that of confusion. What's going on here? And not feeling like I really belonged. And, you know, feeling like each day was kind of pretty hard, pretty tough. And, you know, in the background, lots of money worries. You know, there was never heaps of money, even though my parents worked very hard. In fact, that sort of work ethic has been instilled in all of us children in terms of work hard. But sometimes now in my life to a kind of, I guess, a strength overplayed, because when times are a bit stressful, I go to work hard.
Yeah. Mm,
really interesting.
Head down.
Yeah.
So, and you were the only girl, so you sort of felt a bit left out, I guess.
It was very patriarchal kind of family, I guess.
Yes.
Very much the boys were
the
valued piece of the family. And
it's
so,
such a common theme back there.
Yeah, totally. Yep. You know, my story is everyone's story, really, of that time and in that era. And, you know, I found it very difficult to sort of be flying under the radar the whole time. And, in fact, what happened was I worked earnestly, I guess, to get parents' attention. And in fact, that might be a strength, because I just kept plugging away and plugging away. But certainly, just never felt. And I always knew I had to get out. If I wanted to be who I was, I had to get out. Mm. And so that sort of became my modus operandi.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yep. To get strong, to get educated and
yeah. Yeah, and certainly even by 12 I was working most of the weekend. And
what were you doing?
Yeah, what were you doing?
Well, there was
I'm curious. Washing cars, like, I don't know.
No,
that's what I used to do.
There was a gym / tennis court centre. And my mum had got a part-time job there, and they needed somebody to work from 9 a.m. Sunday till 6 p.m. Sunday and pretty much hold the fort.
Mm. Oh, wow.
So there was about 20 tennis courts and a swimming pool and all that sort of stuff, and kids would come in and do their swimming lessons and whatever. So I made coffees and signed people in for swimming lessons and gave them tennis balls and did the register and whatever. And I did that job for years, actually. And so later on in teenage years, it was hard because all my friends were at sleepovers and I'd be at work.
Yeah, right.
But it gave me money and it gave me things cashola's that my parents couldn't give me. So for a young kid trying to fit in, that money was gold dust because I was able to buy, you know, my shoes.
You had some power and control. Yeah. You probably didn't feel that growing up.
Definitely. And certainly for me, I was always very independent. And I knew from a very early age that the whole family situation was wrong, that I felt and like an alien, and I'd landed in the wrong family.
Yeah, got off at the wrong stop.
Yeah, and I didn't like the abusive kind of nature. I just felt there's a much better way to live, a much better way to parent. But of course, it's seeing it through the eyes of a child too.
That's
so later on in life, I've probably got some different thoughts about that.
However, you've got inner knowing as well. You know, your inner knowing was there, knowing that wasn't right.
Yeah, I just remember, like maybe from four, thinking I've got to do something different here, and I've got to really make sure I've got my wits about me to survive kind of the things that were going on.
Whenever someone's quite sort of overbearing and aggressive, you know, there's always a story, isn't there, you know,
there's
behind that. What do you think was your dad's story that led him to, I guess, you know, express parenting like he did?
I don't know exactly, of course, He was a man of the time, you know. So in fairness to him, he is a man that has the values of, you know, work hard for your family instilled into him, but not much else. So the provider, absolutely, the provider was a really important role, particularly through when his father living through the Depression and having absolutely nothing. So, you know, from adult eyes, I can see that his story probably became one of working hard, and in my mind, he kind of lost his
mojo.
Joy.
Yeah, his joy.
Coupled with, you know, a lot of alcohol going on in my street. It was probably tough for him. But doesn't see that, of course.
Did he give up his dreams, do you think?
I think so, but I really don't know what those dreams were. Certainly he was a really sociable man. He was lead singer in a rock and roll band, you know.
Maybe that's really what he wanted to do.
Maybe. And then you would have been one of those, you know, kids that were sort of following around, you know, touring all around the world.
Could have been
a very different experience.
I remember him bringing out his guitar at like Christmas when there'd been a few drinks and, you know, reclaiming some of that joy, I guess, but only for a moment and then it was gone. So it was always tough to know. I always found it very anxiety filled coming into home and wondering, okay, what am I getting today?
Yeah, that's very scary. That uncertainty of
just at but
is he going to be happy?
Thinking
or is he
about
be
that,
angry?
Yeah, thinking about that last night, preparing for today. I actually feel like it's given me the intuition to know I can go into any room now, know what's going on because I've become so practiced at
aware.
Reading body language and the energy and, you know, all of the cues that sometimes, particularly in organisations, let's say, we just ignore that are there. So I think it's become my advantage. But at that time, I lived in anxiety. It was just, not great.
That's part of your sensitivity.
I think so. I've sort of missed some of the life lessons around how to kind of not
manage
care
them.
Too much about what's going on. And certainly in my later years when I started, you know, working one-on-one with people, I would carry their stuff and it would kind of harm me. It's definitely a bit of a strength. And then once it's sort of overplayed, it's really not great.
Yeah.
So you've asked us to play a song, which is Losing My Religion, REM. What does that song mean to you?
I just love this song because it reminds me of the hundreds of mixtapes that I used to make from Australia's Top 40 on a Sunday night. Sure. You know, 6 p.m. I think it was on the radio, and you'd sit there with your radio and like your hand on play and record and make sure that you got all your favourite songs. And I just remember playing this song over and over and over again and wondering what it meant. But, you know, to me, that kind of losing my religion is like losing yourself. And I always felt really lost. Funny that the band REM came out and said, actually, it wasn't about that at all. You know, they can't believe the popularity of this song because it wasn't meant to be kind of what everyone fed into it. But I just love it took on a life of its own too. And fantastic. For me, it just represents being lost and as a teenager and sort of trying to find my way through the confusion.
You're listening to RPP 98.7, Your Story Counts. And it's going to be 17 degrees today. You're with Nanette and Simone. And in the studio, we have Lee Russell. Listening to her story.
Yeah, Lee.
Such a good story.
Yeah, so we were just chatting about your experience of being, you know, born as an Epping girl. And how, you know, your house was very ruled by that energy of work hard. So what was football to you back then?
Oh, so football's such a weird thing really to talk about because it's kind of been like the shadow that's followed me for a long time in so many different ways. When I was younger, I hated football. You know,
I
traipsed around after my brothers watching their games on freezing cold Sunday mornings, eating dimmies just to keep warm with lots of soy sauce. But those days are sadly over for me. But
did you put them in a roll and have a dimmy roll?
Oh, I used to love dimmy rolls.
Yeah. Shoved them in my face.
Yeah, there was no roll needed.
No, definitely not. But so in my house, football was everything. I think football for my dad, again, represented perhaps an escapism, and he just
who do you barrack for?
He's a Tigers man through and through, and we often joke that if Tigers ever won the flag, he'd just sort of roll over and, you know, give up the ghosts really because that would be his life work done. But so I never imagined that I would be working in it or supporting it or anything in that way. But I recall, like, in childhood, you know, we had to be completely silent when the 6 o'clock replay came on a Saturday night. And for me, I wanted to watch Young Talent Time.
Oh, bless you.
Yeah, Danny Minogue was on.
Absolutely, Danny. Yeah. And so I really resented football. I hated it, actually. I hated how the whole of Melbourne seemed to be completely enthralled with this game that I didn't really understand. So I got into basketball. I loved that and sort of carried on that path a little bit. But bit by bit, football kind of just
creeped in,
kept rearing its head.
Yeah, reoccurring nightmare.
It really was. And
you had to learn to love it. That's why I kept presenting.
Yeah, no, I love it. But what I love now, being sort of a practitioner of it, I guess, is I love behind the scenes. I love helping people be the best they can be. I love game day, but not to watch the game. I've made an art form out of actually not watching the game. I watch people. I watch how they engage.
Interact,
you know, all of that stuff, what they're actually really thinking. And that's really my juice around football. And I love that sport essentially can be such a lever for communities and social change and
releasing anger.
Yes, and bringing people together, some of my greatest moments have been with 100,000 people at the G, all cuddling each other.
Wow,
you know, just like goosebumps stuff. Yeah. So I've had such I've been in it. I've been a wife of it. I've been a child of it. You know, it's just like, come on, football. please leave me alone. It doesn't.
Just
so I go with it.
It's funny because with my family, we weren't into football at all. I guess it's more that English background or something.
Yeah.
But we didn't have that glue. So I do hear what you're saying. Mm. It creates that sense of cohesion, doesn't it? That you sit on a couch, you know, and
brings the family together.
And they all yell and scream. Whereas we were kind of all in our separate locations, probably climbing up trees and climbing
on roofs.
So you
didn't have soccer because you're English?
Yeah, no, there wasn't even
any sport.
I love soccer. Yeah. But yeah, there wasn't even soccer.
I've said for a long time, sport, the only thing sport sells is hope. And actually thinking about my family and families like my family, you know, football meant a lot. And it meant that they had something to look forward to on the weekend. Yeah. And the treks out to Waverley and into the MCG, which wasn't as easy as it is now, you know, they became... It is the religion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There was
football
was
a religion for sure.
Yeah, so very important for lots of reasons, and that's why I sort of take the responsibility of sport and how we're shaping sport to be such an important one.
How did you fall into it? You know, how did it start for you in terms of your career?
I did a teaching degree, an arts degree, then a teaching degree, primarily because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Mm. I was good at people and I had no idea how to kind of make that a career. But I did love teaching. But I then met my now husband, Andrew, and he was already working in AFL, and I started counselling athletes across the kitchen table, essentially. You know, they'd come over for dinner and end up being a two-hour powwow. And that was at the time I was getting qualified in my counselling degrees and whatnot. And so it sort of organically happened. In fact, it's almost like I woke up one day and I was there rather than making it happen. And it was fabulous, actually, because I think if you try and force something like that, it just doesn't happen. Mm. And so it was a really, really somewhat a slow burn, then a complete catapult.
Mm. It sounds totally organic, that it's just grown.
Yeah.
So you started more working with one of the CEOs, is that right?
Well, what happened is we're in Adelaide, and Andrew was working for Port Adelaide Football Club, and they'd won a premiership. Alistair Clarkson was appointed as Hawthorn coach. Mm-hmm. He poached Andrew back to Melbourne to essentially be his right hand man, and I got a job at the AFL Players Association, which was awesome because I got to work with, there were 16 teams at the time, 16 different teams, and seeing all the culture and seeing all the team dynamics. And so I'm forever grateful for that role because it really set me up to then go sort of more directed into sporting organisations and take what I had learnt. And so that's sort of the way in for me.
Okay.
I worked at Essendon Football Club's GM of People and Culture, and that was really interesting because I was the first chick in a footy environment.
Yeah.
Certainly there were other women there, but they were more accountants or, you know, that kind
admin
of role.
Sort of roles,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it was really interesting because people didn't really know what to do with me, particularly senior coaches.
Or communicate with you, probably.
No. Does she go in the change rooms? What does she do? And it was, you know, those days where I was in coaches' boxes and so on, and I would get faxes at the club on a Monday morning saying, you know, get that woman, for lack of a better word, out of the box, because that's why we're losing.
Oh, no.
Interesting.
So the system hadn't really changed.
Supported.
What I love now is that we're not only seeing women come into sport in much more senior and leadership roles, but actually chipping away at the actual system that's not working for anybody.
No.
You know, much less women. Mm. So.
Mm. Wow, that is huge.
Yeah.
And like, you know, what is it, 10 years later, you're still chipping away?
Oh, it's a chipping away process. I mean, back then, you know, I would be told to wear a tracksuit because I needed to be one more like one of the boys. The speed I spoke at was wrong. The way I walked was wrong.
Yeah, you need to have more of a swagger.
Yeah. So come in.
Plodder.
You need to be.
Come into our environment, Lee, but please don't be yourself. And
exactly.
I really struggled with that. I'd been told that for a lot.
It takes you back to your childhood.
It did. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So very much trying to navigate that while in a job I absolutely loved.
Mm.
So it was a pretty difficult time.
Really interesting.
So you've chosen another song, which is Fields of Gold by Sting.
I love this song.
I love this song too.
It's a beautiful song, and actually it's just to honour my husband, really. This is our wedding song. It means something to both of us, you know, through the tough times. I remember it playing and then through obviously the awesome times. But we really forged a friendship and then a relationship, and we've been together, you know, nearly 20 years. We were the most unlikely couple to ever get together and then stay together. And we've had this incredible journey through sport, but also through each other's lives as well. So this song just kind of gets me a bit teary.
Oh,
here it is.
You're listening to RPP 98.7, Your Story Counts, with Nanette and Simone. And in the studio we have Lee Russell telling her story. And we're heading for a top of 17 degrees.
Now, Lee, so we've been just checking in on your story so far, and we're just chatting about the fact that you'd met the gorgeous Andrew a good 20 years ago.
Yeah, we met at uni, actually. I didn't like him so much. He was in the zone of being a young lad, and he was also an athlete. So he you know, athletes are incredibly driven, but they have to be selfish.
Yeah, they do.
And that doesn't often leave a lot of room for other people in their life at that time. So,
and you would have been very mature at that age too.
Well, I'm not. Yeah, probably. But I sort of knew what I wanted too, and that wasn't it.
Yeah.
And
you're looking for security and stability.
Yeah. But he's a beautiful man and an amazing father. And I chose very well. There is some research out there that suggests one of the biggest things that can impact a woman's career is the choice of her life partner.
I've chosen well.
Although let's not paint the Mills and Boone picture, because you know, over 20 years you can imagine there's been ups and downs, and at some points I've hated him and loved him, and you know, all that stuff, the whole gamut. It's there.
But that's real. That's real. Life.
Yeah, that is real.
We keep it pretty real, him and I.
And it's 20 years, you're growing up and changing, aren't you? You're not the same.
In some ways marriage is crazy. You know, like the person you pick in sort of your early to mid 20s or whatever, and then you sort of get into your 40s, of course you're not going to be the same people.
No, but it's all about communication. It is. And willing to grow with one another. I think being authentic, being able to express what you really want.
Totally.
And not expecting someone to mind read you, because that doesn't work.
Mm. Yeah. And for me, there's got to be that mutual respect there. And I think that's what we've always clung to. We've always really clung to, in the tough times, we were friends, and I loved hanging out with him and just really respect him professionally. You know, he's a bit of a guru at what he does. And but, you know, I can also keep his feet on the ground pretty well too. So, I do play that behind-the-scenes role for him, so he can serve others in an environment that is a bit mental.
And also you've had your own successes, so he can respect you and look up to you for what you've been able to achieve in your journey.
It's very mutual. And at the moment we're sort of practicing passing the football, handballing to each other, you know, you go and do your thing, and then, all right, now it's your turn, and back and forth so that, you know, I think the thing that's come with age in a relationship is just the deeper level of knowing, you know, what will work for both of us.
Yeah, because you got a job opportunity, didn't you, to work with AFL up in the Gold Coast to create – you know, a new version of football?
Yes, I went from Essendon to the Gold Coast. One of our executive at Essendon got poached to be the CEO up there. So I went up there for 12 months and commuted back and forth, and I actually loved it. It was one of the best jobs, because building culture is tough, particularly if you've got 150 years of history and tradition and this is the way we do it here type thinking. So for me, that was probably a once-in-a-lifetime role in terms of being able to be influential on how a club might be shaped for the next 20 years.
Shaping the culture,
And we worked out of a tin shed in the searing Queensland heat. You know, there's about nine of us. I mean, it was awesome. It was organisations at their best.
That's fantastic.
And I guess an opportunity for you to do it slightly differently.
Yes.
You know, from everything you've learned up till then, back down here in Melbourne, to changing something.
To Adelaide, to everywhere.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
To
Queensland. And I got a couple of nights a week where I stayed in Broadbeach without children and husband.
God. I would love that.
And I just worked and walked on the beach. And it was a really cool time.
Yeah.
It was a great time.
So, and you felt supported in that time too. So Andrew could look after the kids while you were up there. And maybe not.
Did you just make that up?
My mum probably should get a bit of a nod there. Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing is women have two jobs essentially when they have a job. Job at work, job at home. Yeah. That hasn't changed.
No.
And so I've got a very enlightened life partner, but he can still walk out of the house and go away for 3 days and not think
not have
about
to organise anything.
No, the dinners or the you know, the football or whatever.
Mm. Whereas you have to plan the whole meals and everything. Yeah. Like it's exhausting.
So my mum has really been my wife and through my career. Yeah. And I, you know, she's just been so sacrificing for me.
Really?
I think she needs the
kudos.
There's
always one good woman, isn't there?
I think every mother should have a wife.
Amazing woman.
I think every mother should have a wife.
Well, that's what Annabelle Crabb says in The Wife Drought. She says that the issue with women and work and relationships is that women don't have wives.
I
so
know.
They've got to do it all.
Yeah. So hopefully in the next generation they get more savvy than us and work out how they can have a husband and a wife. Or a wife and a wife, whatever they want.
But I think we should be open to that concept.
That is hilarious. And, and then you went in and, like you said, you already had your two boys and then you had your beautiful girl Imi, who I've met, who is just
so cute.
She just lights up a room but obviously this is where your career was really starting to build because you were getting into being a CEO for Netball Victoria while you were pregnant, is that
yes, right? Yes, I was the CEO at Netball Vic and Melbourne Vixens before I had Imogen continued to be so for a little while after I had her, but I then kind of worked out that having three children sort of adds to the complexity of leadership in terms of, traipsing around Victoria, to see every sort of we had 110,000 members at the time and biggest participation in sport in Australia. So I wasn't really going to do justice to what that needed in a leadership perspective and I certainly wasn't going to do justice to the three kids at home. So I started to think about I needed to do things differently. So I resigned from my position, which I loved, and I think we also all should resign from positions when we love them rather than hate them.
Yeah,
and leave on that high. And I started my own consulting company, which then I could weave around the kids a bit more,
have some more flexibility.
But still really be involved in sporting organisations in the main, but a little bit of corporate. And I really started to hone in on leadership and think about what was going to work and what wasn't, and teach people. And walk alongside them to support their journey.
Well, look at all the knowledge that you gain from having all those other experiences,
amazing,
bringing that all together to actually facilitate change
and
helping people.
I actually love too going in organisations for the first time and kind of dropping grenades everywhere and then seeing how they kind of evolve and then leaving.
Exactly. You sort it out now. Got it sorted. Move on next.
I'm off to Oasis.
Yeah.
Hey, now, you've got two beautiful boys who adore football, which is interesting.
Who do they barrack for?
Full circle.
Hawthorn, of course. They've been born in – Finn was born into the Port Adelaide family. I've got a photo of Finn in the Premiership Cup at 4 months old, which is very cute. But they live and breathe football and Hawthorn. The most beautiful thing for my family at being involved in elite sport there is a family within that team. And so coming to Melbourne with the other mums that had babies at the time, and we would get together once a week and cry and laugh and
support one another
and so those bonds they run pretty deep. The role of family and partners around athletes and coaches is a critical
huge one.
You sort of that happy wife, happy life thing. It actually reverses. If you've got happiness off field, you can somewhat play your best on field. So there's a very clear role for families behind the scenes, and it is a very sacrificing role. So we kind of cling on to each other,
which is lovely that you've got that.
It sounds amazing.
And I don't think people understand when they kind of criticizing particular individuals in sport, that their families are reading that stuff.
I know.
And it can be really hurtful. They're not the ones that are doing the job or in the spotlight, but they're the ones holding that space for that person. So I really value my Hawthorn family.
So one of the challenges you've had all the way through, I guess, in football, if we could just delete ego, it would be a totally different sport. What is some of the damage that ego's done, I guess, to such a big family such as the AFL?
Well, certainly there is a particular system in sport that's not unlike just organisational life, I guess, more broadly. But, you know, sport attracts very passionate people, not necessarily people who have the helicopter view of what a place needs or what a group of people needs. So ego plays a critical role in how things can be very destructive, I guess, in sport. And I guess one of the wishes for the future is to try and get rid of ego and get thinking about pure high performance, you know, and what it actually takes, what it takes for human beings to be the best they can be. So, you know, I've seen terrible things with ego involved, and certainly I think when there's a lot of power in ego, you're having a very different conversation about leadership than one where, you know, it's more collaborative and
coming from the heart.
So I think the challenge for sport in the future is to actually get more heart-centered around leadership.
Yeah,
because I think some of those lads, you know, at football, they're so influenced, aren't they, by, I guess, the other, you know, successful footballers around them. And, you know, if they're clean and clear and got good values and, you know, and are a family person, I guess that's something for them to strive to be.
The interesting thing, though, is the system creates, we create these athletes. We are telling them the implied values or the, you know, what's really goes on here. And so when we see people misbehaving, I think, you know, that's not acceptable. But also the system has set that up.
They've supported that on some level.
We teach athletes to be trained monkeys. We teach them how to, you know, survive in these really sort of crazy environments.
And everything's on a platter to them.
Everything's on a platter. I mean, they're young men. We're talking footballers. Their frontal lobes don't really develop until their late 20s.
And all the girls are waiting at the gates.
Great. And as I said, you know, we treat it like a religion. So of course ego is going to become a part that has something to play in situations like, you know, what we've seen over the last few years in sport. So it takes courage to do things differently.
So yeah, I guess I'm curious, you know, as a final piece on that. So what do we need to do differently so that these young boys can develop those frontal lobes, do you know what I mean, and change what's going on?
Some would argue that they keep developing their frontal lobes for a long time after their 20s.
But exactly. Into their 40s perhaps.
We have to deal with things as they are, not as we wish them to be. You know, and
reality.
Reality and what kind of reality do we want to create. You know, I talk a lot to people about our thoughts create our reality. So we're in charge here.
Yeah.
Let's start thinking about courage and a different form of leadership. Let's dismantle the system of sport and
how it used to work.
Yeah.
We're in a different...
It's not working anymore.
Exactly.
And we've got, you know, half a talent pool that's just starting to be tapped. Imagine if we could, you know, really tap into all the talent and all the diversity and whatever. It would just... The world of sport and the world at large would look and feel so different. And people would be able to be who they're supposed to be. They would remember who they are and they would have the courage they need to be that person and go and do amazing things for our community.
Absolutely. And have a good sense of self.
Absolutely.
Well, we've got another song, which is Love Me Like You Do. Ellie Goulding.
Do you like to tell us about that?
Well, actually, this song comes from 50 Shades of Grey, which is crazy, right? I just like to say I haven't seen the movie or the book or whatever. So
it's just to clarify.
Not really my thing, but I chose this because it actually, for me, sort of exemplifies the beautiful moments I've had in sport. And this particular day was grand final day in 2015. Hawthorn were having a crack at a third premiership in a row. And, you know, internally you know how hard it is to sustain success. Everyone outside starts to just start to expect it and whatever.
Yes.
But, you know, we're all sort of freaking out thinking, God, this is a real task here. And I just had Ellie Goulding was performing in front of 100,000 people at MCG. Wow. The wind was just a soft breeze. I looked at my boys. My boys were just in raptures about just being there on grand final day. I looked at all the families around me. I looked at my girlfriends that I'd had for the last decade and I just had – and then I looked at this amazing performer who, you know, dealing with a footy crowd, they don't want to listen to her, but I kind of tuned into her and I started listening to the words and I just started – crying. Mm. And I was just so grateful for all the experiences I'd had, bad and good and otherwise in sport. And my family was happy. I was happy. And you know, I knew we were going to win the grand final. And we did. And then I had one of the best nights of my entire life, so much so I can't remember it. So it was great.
That's good. Let's have a listen. Here we go.
You're listening to RPP 98.7, Your Story Counts, with Nanette and Simone. And in the studio we have Lee Russell, and we're heading for a top of 17 degrees.
Lee, so we've been nattering about your story that started with Epping and then turned into being a real trailblazer, you know, throughout the footy family. And now expanding again, really. But before we go into that, I'd love to hear more about how do you run your ship, you know, as in your ship, family, because you do have four of them to
look after. You've got four children. You've got a man child.
That's right.
A fur baby that's five.
It's five.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's so interesting doing even public speaking these days, and the prevailing question from women is, you know, I don't know how you do it. And I just hate that question. I think that sets both people up, you know, in terms of, well, how do you do it? Because obviously I can't do it, which is total rubbish. I do it from a place of keeping it real and knowing that some days are going to be better than others. So, you know, some weeks I'm like a maniac, and other weeks I'm all children zen and whatever. And I just actually I've let go of any expectation that I just think this balance thing is just rubbish. You know, if you are passionate and focused, you don't need balance. If you're bored, you're thinking about balance. So I just try my hardest to make sure that we kind of operate in that way and give that value to my kids. But also probably for me, I have a very, very strong value of fairness. So everyone in the family is important.
Yeah.
And, you know, they get their story heard or their,
they
know,
feel heard.
Yeah, they feel heard. And I think I've really focused on making sure that the emotional health of my kids is going to be strong and robust, even though at times, of course, they fall down as well. But I don't try and pull them out too quickly, because I know that some of the hard stuff I've been through has been the making of me.
Yeah, for sure. So interesting.
And they're all so different too, aren't they?
They
are so
different.
I mean, it's hilarious. You've got, you know, three beautiful kids and they couldn't be more different from each other.
I've been gifted three spirits that you know, sometimes I'm just like, I've got no idea why or where you've come from or what's going on here, fellas, but we'll just ride with it. They need different things, and so I'm constantly thinking about how I can mother them individually rather than as a whole.
Which is good.
They sort of they've got different personalities but also different interests, don't they?
And they're just different
Learning styles. So how do you cope with that? Do you sort of, like, you know, talk to one way and then
she multitasks. She's
talk
capable.
To another. You got like three different languages going on all at once.
Well, like everything in mothering and parenting, it's all trial and error, isn't it? So, you know, I start to know what works for one, and, you know, possibly use a bit more of that or whatever. But I think we, you know, one of the things we need to do is debunk the myth that mothering, you just nail it. You know, it's so hard, and I've always just thought I grow with them. So I remember bringing my first home and looking at this alien and thinking, I have no idea from this point. So, but he, neither does he. So let's just, like, kind of
let's
roll.
Let's work together. Let's work together.
So keeping it real is probably my overall, you know, thing.
Yeah, just keep it real. So, you know, football's been fun. You know, we feel that you've been absolutely instrumental in allowing women to kind of comfortably explode into the footy field now.
Now you're taking it to another level. Really?
Well, I have been focusing for the last couple of years on not so much the team environments, but more the whole of sport. You know, I've done a couple of big projects with the Victorian government looking at how women in sport, what are the barriers and how we can remove those barriers, I guess. But also that mentoring and coaching one-on-one, you know, the power of conversation and being able to help people move forward and prepare them for environments and so on has probably become around sport my passion. I mean, I've also done a bit of TV work on The Recruit, which was fun, and so I'm doing lots of different projects in with a bit of fun and a bit of seriousness, and kind of not taking myself too seriously these days either.
She ever mentioned that about the you're so humble. So, yeah. Fuck's sake.
You're a TV star. Can I have your autograph?
They're at a premium, Simone.
What do I have to do to get that?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to make it up.
Probably. Weather girl.
Probably just pass me a bit of paper. But it was such an... what I loved about that experience was, late 30s, learning new skills for the first time. Yep. How often do you get to do that?
I know.
So I kind of took it on. I was really bad. I've never been as nervous as the first filming of the first episode ever.
Really?
I felt like I was going to be sick the whole time.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of went, you know what, let's just ride it like an adventure here. And by the end of the second series, I could see my improvement. So that was kind of really cool and certainly would love to do more in that space to really reach more people and have some influence and
knowledge.
Absolutely. And just share and have some fun too, because I think we can all be too serious about things. And so you can deliver a serious message in and around fun and lightness as well.
So good.
Sure, the Lee Russell Show. That's
right. So now, tell us what you're doing now in Mornington.
So hubby and I have F45 Mornington, which is a group training studio, and we're also just extending that and we've leased another space and we're calling it The Retreat, which will be a meditation space. It'll be a stretching space. It'll be very much when you're at F45, you go, which we love. Yeah. And then when you're in The Retreat, you're sort of getting
wind down,
loved up. Yeah. And we're just really focused on building community and serving their needs and
building a nice culture as well.
Beautiful. And now people are just so beautiful we've just had so much fun really building that from scratch for the last sort of 18 months. So that's my main focus is working in the community in Mornington, but also writing a book and sharing some of these stories about...
Have you got the title? What's the title? I'm always into the titles.
I want to ask that. Yeah, working. I'm wondering if she's actually got it yet.
I'm not sure I can actually say it.
Okay. It's a secret.
The working title is I'm Calling BS.
Okay, love it.
So it's sort of cutting to the chase about the stuff that we can tell ourselves, which is often fiddlesticks, but we hold on to that story, and that impacts then obviously what we are able to do. And so my first book was Game On, and that was published last year, and that was, I guess, a lighter look at things. This one will be very much about... All right, sit down, get a cup of tea.
Get a reality check. This is,
awesome.
We're serious about you being the best you can be.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Amazing. Now, just to finish off, it's been a great hour, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But I want to hear what, knowing who you are now, no offense, but 40, we're half time.
Yeah.
We've got another 40 to go, hopefully.
Plus some.
And more. what would you like to say to that little four-year-old that we talked about right at the beginning?
That's a big question. Thanks for having that as the last one.
Just when you started to relax.
I want to tell her that what she's about to go through and has been through, that it's all for good and that she will be able to use it to create a big life that will have impact on others. And... but possibly what I want to tell her is remember who you are.
Encourage.
Yeah. Just, find people that are like you sooner. Mm. Don't worry about things as much. And go from the heart as well as the head.
Yeah.
That's very beautiful.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, Lee. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think in a way we all needed to hear that, don't we?
Yes. My little girl needed to hear it.
Yeah, she needed to hear it. All right. Well, we're just going to finish off with the last song, which is A Scars to Your Beautiful, Alicia Cara.
Yeah, don't know too much about this artist at all, except I just love the message and my life work now is about working with people to really kind of debunk all of the crazy myths on social media about what it means to be a decent human and a fantastic woman. And so I love her message.
Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.